Beware, spoiler phobes, you've stumbled upon a storm of spoilers.
Replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. But if they're a benefit, it's not my problem.
It's your birthday. Someone gives you a calfskin wallet. How do you react? Describe in single words only the good things that come into your mind about your mother. You're watching a stage play. A banquet is in progress. The guests are enjoying an appetizer of raw oysters. The entree consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice.
Your job once. I was good at it.
Things were simpler then.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I were to run with a blade, it would obviously be Wesley Snipes.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to run with a blade, it would definitely be a katana. Why not?
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm pretty sure that whatever blade I were to run with, it would be the friends we made along the way.
Da 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 da. You're here for a very serious episode of Storm of Spoilers, despite what that intro might have made you think. We're here to discuss Blade Runner, both 2049, which is currently in theaters, and the first Ridley Scott movie, which is an adaptation of Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I didn't read that one, but it is important to sort of lay that all out. Joanna, first of all, is phoning in from a present day Los Angeles, we're pretty sure, but we want to make sure. Are you okay over there, Joanna? It seems like your country's on fire.
I'm okay because I'm in Los Angeles, but yeah, Northern California is definitely like post-apocalyptic seeming right now. So I'm okay. A lot of my family has been evacuated. I didn't come to LA to escape the fire, but I so happen to have missed most of it. So yeah.
All right, we're going to have to keep an eye on that and like ways to help out fire damage as we go forward. But we're glad you're safe. I'm glad you could join us. I'm sure you have amazing thoughts on Blade Runner, but I'm pretty sure that because of the extenuating circumstances, you're not looking at a review right now. Am I wrong?
Well, I was looking at reviews earlier. Let's see if that's still open on iTunes. I was looking just for ego reasons. Yep, it's still open. Okay. but the last review we got was October 2nd. So I was noticing that we haven't gotten a lot of new reviews recently. So my ego thanks you for that. Because usually I get sad about bad reviews. Okay, so I'm going to read a bad review. This one comes from JRhodes55. One way to ruin a podcast, one star. After making a point to read the social justice review, I thought I'd leave a review of my own. Y'all do a good podcast, but I'm tired of podcasters ruining a podcast with their garbage opinions. Gender is not a construct. Gender roles are a construct. Little boys can play with Barbies. Little boys can't be girls. Good podcast. Wish you wouldn't have ruined it with your personal agenda. My response to that is, you're the worst. Okay. And then, I'll read a positive review that has like a somewhat similar message, which is 5 stars. I liked Iron Fist Frowny Face from Dispo. And Dispo says, I love listening to you guys. I could do with a little less social justice. I did like Iron Fist, so that episode is the only one that made me sad. Anyway, what are the chances of a Dragon Ball Z off-season episode? Great question, Dispo. I've never seen a single Dragon Ball Z episode. it's a show, right? It would require a lot of catch up on my part. What are your guys' Dragon Ball Z thoughts?
I would recognize Dragon Ball Z because I have watched episodes, but would I be able to like tell you about the different eras of Dragon Ball Z and what they mean? No, I do have friends that could catch me up in a speedy way if we needed to like bring in an expert, but I don't have good Dragon Ball Z base knowledge.
For me, Dragon Ball Z is fairly indistinguishable from Pokemon, so I think that we just lost some listeners. I'm like the worst person to ask about any of that stuff. It's after my time. It's one of those like my little brother, who's 6 years younger than me, was of the Pokemon Dragon Ball Z era. So I don't know. I will talk to you all day about Ninja Turtles if you want.
Yeah, Pokemon wasn't like a thing for me growing up at all, but like the generation right behind me, or not even generation, just like right behind me, Pokemon is so important. But we were talking about Dragon Ball Z, not Pokemon. Hashtag not all cute things and balls. So
hashtag not all balls.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you for the reviews. At least the second one gave us 5 stars. And as you could see, we thoughtfully thought about your topic because we listen to 5-star reviews. Neil.
Right. And also, congratulations, you liked Iron Fist.
Oh, yeah. Actually, you know what? If you did like Iron Fist, I don't want to like hold, you know, people's feet to the fire for liking things. I just had a lot of things to think about it. But anyway, let's not get bogged down in the immortal Iron Fist. Neil, let's talk about some things we've already talked about that aren't the immortal Iron Fist.
Yes, we have some things to talk about that we talked about already. Quick reminder about t-shirts. I got a shipping notification today from Cotton Bureau telling me that my Ghosted and the other one, Tormund Lives, t-shirts have shipped. So great on you. If you didn't get a shirt, you can still go to cottonbureau.com, search A Storm of Spoilers, and get on the list to request some of the old designs. And as soon as they hit a certain threshold, they get brought back. So, you know, if you missed out on the t-shirts, or if maybe you missed a payday, you know, didn't line up or whatever, go ahead back to the website and put in your email and they will let you know when they're back on sale. So those are t-shirt updates. There is some Game of Thrones news, just some light stuff, mostly just that Game of Thrones season 8 has begun. They've begun table reads. They are going to begin filming very shortly. This is all information we know because actors have been spotted in Belfast. The other cool thing, I don't know if this is cool because... No, it's cool. Game of Thrones production for season 8 is going to be upping security so that we don't have these exceptional spoilers as we did last year. But I feel like they're focusing on the wrong part of this, but in an awesome way. Because if we remember correctly, last year, all of the big leaks came from like people leaking synopsis from the scripts or, you know, so it came from like inside the production-ish sort of things. It did not come from drone pictures necessarily. That was season 6 when we found out that Jon Snow was still, you know, traipsing around the north. But they are going to be using drone hunting eagles on set this year to attack drones. And I think that's the most Game of Thrones possible way to deal with that problem.
Best story I've ever heard. That's so good.
Yeah, I know, right? It's not going to solve their problem either. but it is an awesome way to solve a problem that they think they have.
Yeah. Yes. The biggest spoiler that came out of this week of Game of Thrones was posted by a member of the cast. So look inside yourselves, Game of Thrones. I mean,
right.
There were some drone photos last year of like... Jon Snow and Daenerys meeting on like, I saw those photos, you know, so like those existed last year. That was kind of a bummer for people, but the major leaks that we saw last year came from on the script level and, you know, careless whispers from the cast. So that happens.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, There's also a rumor that the scripts are being kept under lock and key, and the cast can only have them when they are rehearsing, and none of them are able to take them with them, type of thing. I can't wait to someday get the full story of what the hell's going on. So anyway, yeah. But drone hunting eagles is the new thing this week. There is also something else going on in pop culture that we should talk about.
Do we not want to talk about the spoiler that came from the table read?
What was the spoiler that came from the table read?
Well, I'm going to say it. I don't think there's any way they're going to. Yeah, I'm just going to say it, guys. Skip ahead if you don't want to hear this. Our t-shirts have been confirmed. Christopher Hinkew posted a photo on Instagram of himself at the table read and then deleted it. Derp.
Oh, well, this is great news. I just found out about this. Hooray!
Yeah, that was the moment. We got to go with it live with Neil.
I was very confident in that anyway, because as I said before, I did the math. But also, I think it's important to note that this is the third or fourth time in a row that our t-shirts have been exactly right. So, you know, you guys should buy more t-shirts from us.
They're prophetic.
Yes, our prophetic t-shirts. Speaking of other things that I was prophetic about, remember that time I said they should just call the next Star Wars movie The Last Jedi? That was pretty awesome.
I do, Neil. So, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember it too.
Yeah, it was pretty great. So that movie,
is this things we've talked about before? Because you've not only talked about that before, but like how great you are that you predicted it before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you're still great.
Yes, we're covering all the bases here. But I thought that maybe we should carve out a little time and talk about the Last Jedi trailer, which came out this week, because I don't think we're going to have a time to do a whole Star Wars episode until closer to the release of this film. So I was curious. I tweeted many things about intense facial expressions that I thought were interesting. But I'm curious to hear what you guys thought of the trailer and if you noticed anything super interesting. Joanna, how do you feel about the Last Jedi trailer?
I really liked it. I was one of those people that like thought maybe people were like being kind of silly and overreacting about the porgs, because I'm like, what if they're terrible? We saw, you know, just like a split second of a porg sort of like squawking. It's the best thing I've seen all year. So I'm on team porg now.
Nice.
I like to follow closely Mr. Gonzalez, when these things happen, because he, observed some minutiae that I might've missed. And one thing that he pointed out, I'm just going to jump all over maybe what he said. One thing that he pointed out that I thought was really interesting is like, don't ever believe shot reverse shot in trailers. So there's a scene where, you know, Rey says, I just want to know my place in all of this. And she's looking up and she's looking despairing, and then cut to Kylo Ren sort of like holding out his hand to her. I was like, come with me if you want to live or whatever. And Dave pointed out that maybe those aren't the same shot, and like looking at it closely, like the fire is falling behind him, but it's not really falling in the light reflection on her face. Anyway, so what I'm saying is there's maybe some manipulation going on. I'm really excited. Yeah.
I felt the same way about the shots of Kylo Ren about to shoot down the big ship and it being about Leia. Either that's like them sort of giving away a lot, or there's some manipulation going on there. But I'm curious to hear if Dave thinks that that's the case.
Okay. So Joanna's thing, I want to say the key to figuring out the trailer timeline wise, especially with those reverse shots, is Rey changes outfits and has two outfits throughout the film. She might be wearing a cloak over something, but she has two basic outfits. So if you look at the collar and the fabric where it ends on her wrists, or if it comes down onto her hands, you could tell whether she's in the outfit she arrives in or her Jedi training Snoke showdown outfit. So the reverse shot with Kylo Ren, she's in the first outfit, which makes it seem very unlikely that that's at the climax of the film when those two are going to like sort of meet each other. To Neil's question, first of all, I have to say that everything that I've reported about The Last Jedi has been absolutely denied by people that claim to think that The Last Jedi is happening. But what I heard a while back last year was that the original plot for Leia was that she would be injured, and that would throw Poe and Laura Dern's character, Admiral Holdo, into a struggle over what to do with the Resistance, who's fleeing that attack that we see in the trailer, which is going to happen early on in the film. But that being said, the way that it's positioned as part of this space battle with Kylo Ren about to shoot something and feeling guilty about it, I don't know if that's the thing that's still going to disable her. I do think that happens just because of the facial expression that Adam Driver's making, and the fact that his scar has been recently sealed with some sort of like back to tape means that that's like seconds after the end of The Force Awakens. He gets off Starkiller Base, he gets in his thing, and he goes after his mom. And then I think it's going to be obviously very emotional for him, and that maybe what has him pull back, when maybe instead of Leia getting like taken out for a period of time, she's now just almost injured, because we have to make the most of what we can with Carrie Fisher's part. So it'll be interesting to see, but yeah, I've been having fun frame by framing that second trailer. I think if the little bits that I've been assuming are true, that I have the plot now. I don't have any of the revelations of what the plot, but in terms of where we go and why we go there, I'm really close.
So this is where I want to say that Dave and I got into not like a fight, but a little disagreement over like spoilers and watching trailers and whatever.
Dave got into an argument with people about watching trailers. That's crazy.
But like Dave and I disagree about this. And like, what's true is that, you know, and I'm just going to confess this on the Storm Spoiler podcast, like I just stopped listening to Dave for the last minute and a half while he was talking, because I didn't want to hear what he had to say. I just sort of like turned it down. And I don't know how I'm going to survive being friends with Dave until The Last Jedi comes out. And I'm not saying that knowing those spoilers, anyone who listened to that, and not that they're spoilers, they're like information that Dave has pieced together. I'm not saying knowing any of that is going to make the experience less for other people. But for me, in this particular case, I'm kind of leaning towards preferring to know less.
I don't want to, like I was saying before with like the reviews, I don't want to talk people out of something that works for them or is enjoying, but I do want to say that my entire brand is maximum amount of input information, put something out. So that's definitely going to be the way that I'll be covering Star Wars, but I'll try to, you know, ease back on the throttle a little bit for everybody, including Joanna. I only care about Joanna, but for everybody.
It's gonna be weird when we do a Star Wars episode later in the fall.
Are we gonna do it after we see the movie? I'm seeing it really early. You guys can't touch me.
Yeah, that's fair. By the time we actually do a Star Wars movie, it'll just be us asking you questions about the movie that you saw and we didn't.
We'll figure it out. But it'll be fun.
Cool. So I think we're all pretty thumbs up on that trailer. I liked it.
Yeah.
I thought
it
was good. I'm excited. I'm ready for BB-8 and Porgs. I already bought a Porg. My Porg story that I have not yet had a chance to tell is that I bought one for the dog. And she does this cute thing where she doesn't destroy things that are animal like. Like if you give her a toy that's not like an animal, she'll just destroy it. But if you give her like a penguin or a rabbit or a porg that looks like some kind of animal, she just rips the stuffing out. Like she very carefully creates a hole and then pulls the stuffing all out. And so it's just like a thinner version of itself. So I have the skinniest porg in the galaxy in my house.
That's really cute. I like this hole I bought this porg for a dog. Like we were talking to Katie Rich, friend of the show, and she's going to buy a porg for her baby. And I'm like, friends, Romans, countrymen, you don't need an excuse to buy a pork. You don't need a dog or a baby. You can buy yourself a pork.
Right. You can buy a pork.
I grant you permission. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't saying you couldn't buy a pork. I have seen other people. I mean, like when I got the BB-8 2 years ago, I was like, oh, the cat will love it. The cat had no interest in the BB-8 other than knocking its head off. And I was like, oh, I'll be honest with myself. I bought the BB-8.
Well, I guess it's time to do one of our most significant time jumps as we go from a galaxy far, far away, way into the future for Blade Runner. I guess it's the best place to start is with the original. It seems a lot less, important now, but before Blade Runner 2049 came out, I was in a couple chat discussions, probably with both of the hosts, about the difference between the original Blade Runner being considered a masterpiece and a cult classic, and whether both of those can apply. Ridley Scott's Blade Runner has some great Harrison Ford, has some great cinematography, basically gave birth to a certain neo-noir version of the future in the 80s that would echo out and is still being used now for non-Blade Runner things. We wouldn't have The Matrix. We wouldn't have all these amazing things that I enjoy in science fiction if we didn't have this very ponderous and very thoughtful adaptation of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep about replicants. Let's start with Neil. Neil, when did you first see Blade Runner, and would you classify it as cult classic, masterpiece, or both? Neither is also an option, I suppose.
Ooh, I like all this. I like all these different options. I love options. I actually saw it probably sometime in the late 90s when I was in my teens, and didn't really understand it at the time, to be honest. Didn't get the hype. But I was also like 13, so I didn't understand a lot of things about a lot of things. So I will say this, having revisited it recently, I think there is a difference between a movie that is a substantial technical achievement or substantial work of art and like a great movie. Like there are clearly reasons why Blade Runner may not have caught on in the early 1980s when it was released in the theaters, and why it ultimately flopped. And I think a lot of these you could apply to the new one, is that it's a little weird. It's big. It's plotting. It's, you know, meditative. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's the reason why people read a bunch of John Grisham novels and not want to read Philip K. Dick, because there's an accessibility that it lacks. But when you dig into it, there's a thoughtfulness that it has that is exceptional. And I think that's what made it so enduring. Like when people finally got around to like sit down and kind of pull it apart, it's a really, really well-made film. So is this my long way of saying that it is a masterpiece? Yes.
Masterpiece.
Well, I think and this is why it's hard to call new films masterpieces, because I think in order to get to masterpiece, a film has to have enough time to show its influence out in other films and other TV series and other mediums. So I think that's how you define a masterpiece. You know, is it entertaining the day it comes out in theaters? Does it change the way other filmmakers make movies later in life? And, you know, I think that's why like Star Wars is a masterpiece, even though, you know, I mean, I guess you could pick out a bunch of reasons why Star Wars, that first Star Wars isn't necessarily a great movie, but it is a masterpiece of influence, a titan of influence, maybe.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on your definition of masterpiece, but that's what I'm going with.
I mean, I think the definitions can be purposely vague because that makes for a more interesting conversation. Joanna, same question to you. When did you first engage with Blade Runner, and where does it fall on the cult classic masterpiece neither scale?
I saw it as a kid, and it really stuck with me. Like, that thing is, like, it's, I think if you see it when you're really young, the imagery of it just really, really, really sticks with you. And then when I saw it again later, like, I don't know, at a second run movie theater with friends, I was like, oh, this is very slow. but I do enjoy rewatching it, actually. And I have done several times. And I would agree with Neil about it being a masterpiece for exactly the reason that he said, the influence of the visuals and the sound and everything that comes with it. A cult classic, I want to say, like, is something like Tremors, not to go back to Tremors, but, like, you know, it's something like that, where it, like, it had, or Buckaroo Banzai, like, it has a following, a passionate following, but I don't know how, you know, how much of a huge impact they made on the filmmaking culture. Yeah, so I'll go ahead and send for Masterpiece. Yes.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm going to have to be the one that came in and say that I watched the director's cut first in the mid-90s and then realized that I had previously engaged with it when I was too young to realize what was happening. So much like Joanna, I have Snake Woman images and I have owls with red eyes and I have Tears in the Rain, but I didn't have a lot of the connecting pieces. So I got to see the director's cut, which I'm sure even made me think was even more boring, because without any voiceover and with all these mood shots, you really feel the, I guess, 70s version of what 40s noir was, feeling off the whole movie. And I guess I'm going to be the one that says I think it's more of a cult classic than a masterpiece, which isn't to say that it isn't influential. It's just, I think a masterpiece movie is a movie that even its flaws stand up to, like, a certain degree of scrutiny that I don't think Blade Runner does. I think Blade Runner, because of its interesting cut history and because it's one of the prime examples of when studio meddling got unrolled to reveal a full movie that had always been there, I think it makes it amazing, but I don't think that it's quick enough or lean enough for me to reach masterpiece. The interesting thing is that I've had a lot of time to think about Blade Runner, and that's where I land on. And my Blade Runner 2049, which we'll like get to, might be something that gets better with time. But having time to dissect the first one, I feel like I fully appreciated it. And I feel like I like it, but I still feel uncomfortable saying it's a masterpiece just because it's not super rewatchable. It's not a Star Wars. It's not a Jurassic Park. It's not a Casablanca, even if you're a geek like me that watched a lot of Casablanca when you're a teenager. So I'm gonna put cult classic, not masterpiece, which isn't to say that it.
Okay.
I still don't really like it. I'm just not sure.
I'm glad you added.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm glad you added Casablanca to that list, because initially you were just like, these are like fast-paced, like action blockbuster fun movies, which is great. Those movies are great. We all love those movies. But like, I would bristle, if you left it there, I would bristle at those being the only options for masterpiece, you know?
Well, when I was having this argument with Java, I brought up Requiem for a Dream, which I really love, but just because of the emotional weight of watching it, I'm not going to watch it a ton, because who wants to feel like that all the time? But when I was in college, I made myself watch it like once a year, because it has these things in it, like the quick cutting drugs, like that trick where the camera is anchored to the person, so the perspective shifting around them, that I feel are like masterpiece level techniques. I just don't want to revisit the movie like Jurassic Park. So I feel like there's masterpiece could also be something that's not clipping or even comfortable, but it's still something that you look back on and you're like, wow, that was something.
Yeah, I think that there are like Schindler's List, I think, is a masterpiece, but I don't want to rewatch it ever, you know? So I don't know how much rewatchability should come into Masterpiece. You know, that being said, like, I think that, you know, the things that we're admiring a fun blockbuster for and Blade Runner for, I found both of those things in like Mad Max Fury Road. Like, I think there are rare occasions where you can find both of those things. And I think that's a problem. An issue with Blade Runner is that because Ridley Scott directed it and he, you know, would go on to direct some other sort of bigger genre films, I think, right? Yeah. And because it's sci-fi, I think a lot of people like expect Blade Runner to be a Star Wars or something like that. And it just never was, nor was Alien. You know, like, Alien is a moody, slow horror film that Ridley Scott directed. And so I think, you know, Aliens is the blockbuster version of Alien, and Blade Runner has always been this like slow, moody thing that I think got this weird other reputation because of, I don't know, gifts of Daryl Hannah or whatever. And then I'm just really grateful. We don't need to pivot hard to the new version yet, but like, I'm just really grateful that in this movie landscape where it's really hard to get a big movie made at all, unless it has intellectual property attached to it and the branding attached to it. And so Blade Runner does have that. You know, Denis Villeneuve got to make a weird, slow sci-fi film because he could call it another Blade Runner film. And you know, that may not have paid off at the box office for the studio. That investment may not like return, but I'm really glad that that Blade Runner 2049 exists and that, or even some, okay, no, I'll not get off topic.
there's a lot to say about Blade Runner 2049. So let's maybe see if there's anything really important that we need to say about Blade Runner. I went back to rewatch the final cut the first time for this podcast. Was kind of surprised it was just new backgrounds and color grade, and not really sure that I was into that new color grade. But in rewatching it and reading a fantastic piece on, I believe, Vox about a person of color watching Blade Runner for the first time, I was really struck of how much when I first watched Blade Runner, it was about androids, and how now when I watch Blade Runner, it was about personhood, and how as I age, the movie changed for me in that way. And then obviously there's also things like the forced consent sex scene that comes across completely different in a modern context. Or maybe just I wasn't old enough to see that and recognize that for what it was. It certainly is a weird comment on, I think, very specifically disposable women, which in Rachel kind of has to... No, Rachel doesn't have to hold down. The disposable women aspect of Blade Runner, I feel, is sort of amplified in 2049 in maybe to the detriment of the personhood argument. But I will say that rewatching Blade Runner, the final cut, post Black Lives Matter and post, you know, a mild feminist awakening of general society, really shows that like doing good thematic science fiction is going to age well, like for forever. That was a huge statement. Added a question. Go ahead. Yes, Joanna.
I remember having conversations about, I mean, you called it forced consent. I would call it rape, but we can decide what we want to call it on our own, I guess. But I had conversations about that around in the 90s. So is there any way for me to have said that to be like, I'm a better feminist than you are?
I was a teenage boy in the 90s. The teenage boys are horrible feminists.
That's long been a problem scene of the original Blade Runner. But mostly because I just don't think the movie tries to examine it at all. I think you could have that scene in there and try to examine it. But the fact that like Deckard and Rachel like run off and in 2049, it's like they were the love of each other's lives. And so I'm like, well, then that's not, I don't know. That scene is massively disturbing to me. But I do like the reframing of it in the context of Black Lives Matter and sort of examining it as, I don't know. I think I'm just yes-anding all your personhood comments. But the last thing I'll say is one of the things that I liked about Blade Runner originally was its ambiguous ending. And I'm sort of irritated. I mean, I don't mind if 2049 feels like it resolves what the question of whether or not Deckard is a replicant. I think that's an interesting open-ended question. And it's sort of like the top spinning at the end of Inception, which people make fun of. But like, it feels like in interviews ever since, Ridley Scott has been knocking that top over. And it's just like, yeah, he's a replicant. The fuck? Of course he's a replicant. And it's like, okay, but like, isn't it more interesting if we don't know? I don't know. Neil, do you have any thoughts on the ending of the original Blade Runner?
I always assumed he was human. For better or worse, I guess. I guess I had forgotten up until recent rewatches how sort of hopeful the ending of Blade Runner is. And that always surprises me, because the whole movie is a hard movie, like a tough movie. And, it sort of has this weird hopeful ending, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I have to say on that.
I was always part of, well, I was the nihilist film student that was like, of course he's a replicant because that means they only get to be happy for 4 years together. Like, that was always my thing, is that they would both.
Ooh, see, but I always interpreted
Isn't she like an extended life model?
That's only in the voiceover and 2049. That's not in the.
Oh.
Okay.
The original movie.
Yeah, see, I always took that ending to be that he was going to be in love with her, but he knew that she wasn't going to last. Like, he knew that she was like, only going to live for like 4 years.
Right.
And that's part of the sadness interplaying with the sort of optimism of escaping.
Yeah, I guess I always just thought that the reason you, like, we already know that Edward James Olmos characters makes the origami, and then we see the origami is the unicorn, and then the reason we hear the voiceover line, you know, she won't live, but then again, who does, is that's the moment he realizes it about himself, and that's why he has that one look where he, like, grasps the unicorn and then turns around with purpose. I always thought that he was like, 4 years, and let's make the best of my shit artificial life. But then he shows up super old in the next movie. So, FML Dave from 97, you were a horrible person. You had bad opinions about movies.
Well, not that, but like, I feel like, can we move into 2049 and A and B? Are we talking spoilers?
Yes, we could move into 2049. Let's ease into spoilers maybe after this break. And we're back talking Blade Runner 2049. I'm super okay going full spoilers right out the bat. Is that how we want to do it?
I think it's good. What do you think, Neil? Yeah? Okay.
Yeah, no, I think this is the segment for people who have seen the movie.
There
we go. I was going to say that, like, the whole age, like, someone who sort of light reading the movie was like, oh, Deckard's obviously a human because he aged. And I'm like, no, he's a replicant. Like, that's the whole thing. It's like replicant, procreation. It's a whole thing. But him age, like, why would a replicant age, right? And so him aging really does make the whole other conversation around the fact that they brought back Rachel as like a CGI Uncanny Valley Sean Young. And the reason she's young is because Rachel died in childbirth. She would never have been older. Like, this is the Rachel he would know. He wouldn't necessarily know a Rachel that looks like Sean Young now, but like, there's this, all this meta shit around it in terms of like, well, first of all, I didn't think the face looked good, and I know people disagree with me, but I thought it looked not better than Leia in Rogue One, worse than Kurt Russell in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And since the rest of Blade Runner 2049 looks so good and none of the special effects look like dopey, I was like, this is a dopey special effect. If they had just like kept like shot her from behind, I think it would have been more effective for me because her silhouette is so identifiable that you don't need to show the CGI face. But anyway, like Sean Young, the actress who plays Rachel, like has had this like crazy life story in Hollywood and like all this shit has happened to her. And like, because of that, it makes the other narrative of like, well, let's just use her young, like further growth to me. That being said, we could pretend that it's a meta way of talking about disposable women because we've got this other character that I do love, which is the hologram character, Joy, who is, you know, Ryan Gosling K's girlfriend's companion in a pocket. And I love that character. And I love what that character said about fantasy. And I thought that that was a really brilliant, all the use of holograms in this movie, really brilliant. So, yeah. Do you guys have any issues with young Sean Young, or what did you think?
Just from a polygon angle, I give it a B+. Nothing's going to beat Tarkin, and I don't care what you guys say. I know more than you do.
I mean, I thought it looked great, like everything else in the movie. I've never thought about it in the context of like Sean Young's like real life before. That adds a layer of like, you know, like weird.
I can't figure out why they make her why they give him the line that misrepresents her eye color. Like, she never had green eyes. So what the fuck is that line supposed to be?
Wait, she didn't have green eyes in the first one?
No. They did a really good CG recreation of replicant Sean Young, and then the thing that Harrison Ford's Deckard says to prove that it doesn't get over him, it just, I don't think it's true. I've never seen a shot of Sean Young from the first Blade Runner where she has green eyes. They're brown, so you could see the red when they reflect off the pupils, which they decided not to do this time. Anyway, it's weird. There's a lot of weird, yeah, there's a lot of weird things about this Blade Runner 2049. And the reason I was saying earlier that I didn't like it when I got out of it because I felt like it had cheapened the thematic purpose of the first Blade Runner with this Christ story, which changes everything. So you don't have a character like Roy, who's like, I was being used as a slave and I don't want to do that. And I shouldn't have like a limited slave lifestyle. I'm a person. You have these things can reproduce, which brings them like absolutely up to personhood for most people thinking it, except for Jared Leto's character, who's just like, if we let people rape their robots and that makes new robots somehow, then I could solve all the world's problems. So you have like this Paradise Lost thing going on, and then they make his like phone ringing thing, Peter and the Wolf, and then Nabokov's Pale Fire shows up on screen and as parts of it, and then there are bees in the desert just so a bee could land on his arm and he doesn't swat it. Like the Void Comtes said, a wasp lands on your hand in the desert. And we only go to Las Vegas so we could be in a desert, so that question makes sense. It's just all these like pieces of a symbolism tone poem laid over a Christ story that I felt was just like, ugh. Like, if you're just going to show me a guy named after, I don't know, the main character of the trial and, you know, show him go through a weird bureaucracy as a non-person, and then at the end have him be like, I'm okay being a non-person. I feel like we don't need to get all mixed up in whether or not these machines can reproduce and if we should still consider them machines, because Robin Wright's character is right. As soon as you realize that replicants can give birth, that's a world breaker. And then they also do a weird thing where our main character that we're sympathizing with is a replicant, and he has this girlfriend who's an artificial intelligence, so like a replicant's replicant. And so it's, I feel like because the central question of is our main character a replicant, is he a cop who's shooting other people that he's deemed okay, is he, you know, retiring people without consciousness, or is he doing this to themselves, is just done away with in the first 5 minutes of this movie. And what the vacuum is replaced by is a plot that I was just like, ugh, this is making lesser of your themes and visuals. Like, it could have just been Koyana Scotsy of this world, and I think I would have been just as into it. And that sound is the mic dropping, and we will move on.
All of Dave's opinions are the right opinion. No. well, I found Ryan Gosling emotionally accessible, actually. But sort of as emotionally accessible as I find Harrison Ford in the first film, which is, like, not super emotionally accessible, but they're, like, they're the gumshoe characters. Like, those characters aren't that, you know, emotionally profuse or whatever. And I felt like Ryan Gosling's vulnerability, especially around the Joy character, and then also his reserve, and then the scene where he thinks he finds out that he is the son, like his outburst there is so different from what we've seen from him that it like actually startled me. And I know that you, Dave, were dealing something else in that scene because you had, like, figured out the twist or whatever. But, like, I don't think the twist makes this movie. Like, I think the twist makes this movie in that I think it would have been really dumb if Ryan Gosling was the son of Deckard and Rachel, because that seems like what it was in the trailer. And I was like, please let it not be that. So the fact that it was not that, like, delights me. But the fact that, like, I don't really care that it was like, oh, a big twist. Oh, my God, it's not him. You know, like, that. I don't really care about that. I just care that it wasn't him. I don't care who it was or where she was. And that being said, sequences like that where you see that character, I don't remember her name, I apologize, the woman who is their daughter who makes the dreams or the memories, that scene is freaking incredible. How lucky are we to have had that scene in a movie this year? I was just watching with jaw drop because, like, the actress is incredible. That technology is amazing, what they were working with there. And just the whole, and then his, like, urgency of needing to know something. I love that scene. And there are just so many moments like that in 2049 that are, like, blow you away, astonishing as far as I'm concerned. Neil, I know you liked this better than either Dave or I did. Like, what were your overall thoughts about, I don't know, the ambition of it or how it succeeds emotionally?
Yes, I liked it. It was good. It was a good movie. Movie is good. I'm not going to let Dave talk me out of this. I really liked it. It's a very visually interesting film, just like the first one. So what I thought walking out of it was I guess I was less concerned about the story and more concerned about existing in that world, because I thought that was, to me, the most interesting thing about the first movie was the world that it built, rather than, you know, the larger sort of philosophical questions. And really the philosophical questions always, to me, break down to a very simple, like, at what point are you really alive? And, you know, can we say that Rutger Hauer's character in the first one, you know, his quest for freedom, is that, did he really live at the end? Was he really sort of essentially no different than human? And so this one obviously takes that sort of to the next level, which is like, can replicants reproduce? And if so, does that make them any different from humans? And does that, as we discuss, break the world? So thematically, fine. I'm good with all that. But what really struck me about this movie, one, is that it's a bold way to make a blockbuster, which I think should not be undersold. It's very ambitious and very ballsy to make this kind of movie for hundreds of millions of dollars at a studio. And maybe Warner Brothers maybe they thought, you know, that it was a little bit more mainstream appeal than there really was. But, you know, if this is the kinds of swings and misses we're going to get as far as mainstream appeal of classic films getting turned into sequels, I'm fine with that. Keep us swinging. But I think, you know, it's a similar thing to what I really liked about The Force Awakens. And I know we got a lot of Blade Runner Star Wars crossover here, so y'all are welcome. But you think about when you make a sequel to a movie that was 30 years ago, you don't want to make it so that it looks exactly like that movie, because that movie is a product of its time. You want to make sort of the fully realized version of that. So when I watch Denis Villeneuve's film, I feel like this is the version of Blade Runner that Ridley Scott had in his head. Like, this is the world that he had in his head. And in 1982, he did the best he could to bring that to life. In 2017, it really now feels like it exists. So I was just sort of wide-eyed through the whole thing, just caught up in what a masterful technical achievement the whole thing was. And even down to exactly what Joanna was describing, just the performances in the moment and the way the film allowed you to sort of simmer on some of its questions. I actually was sort of caught up with the surprise. Like, I was convinced that he was the kid, and then I was surprised when he wasn't the kid, mostly because I didn't pick any of that up from the trailers. because as we've experienced, as I get older, somehow I get dumber. But so I thought it was just all lovely. The emotional journey of the K character to me is great. And Ryan Gosling is fantastic in the film. And I think that it worked really well. And it was just enough Harrison Ford to be interesting and not too much to get a little, you know, like, you know, it's clear that they made this movie because they had a further things to say on the themes, rather than, oh, we're just going to make another movie with Harrison Ford in it. I felt similarly about The Force Awakens, where it was like, they didn't do it just so that they could bring back the original cast. They kind of did it because there's like a new story they want to tell, and the original cast kind of helps. So I loved it. I thought it's hard to say that we're, like, there are a few filmmakers that operate on that level that are working today that are being given money to make films. So I think I'm all in on Denis Villeneuve. He's basically like a hipper Christopher Nolan, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm for more of it. And I actually probably more interested in watching this one again than I was the first time I saw the original.
This is so frustrating, because I agree with like 80% of what you said. Like, and I agree with like 80% of what Joanna said. Those scenes are brilliant, with the exception that we should have just been on Ryan Gosling. We don't need a flash of who the actual daughter is. You're going to take us there anyway. And then like the things shot and the world building is great. Like the fucking Wallace building, wherever it is, with just water constantly providing the light source, regardless of where the room is. And sometimes you can't even see the water. Just mystifying. And then I especially liked the San Diego child labor trash zone, just in terms of design and execution. My problem is I'm not quite sure why we needed it, just to like show that San Diego's a trash pile, I guess. But like, yeah, that's why this movie's so frustrating. And so I'm not counting it out of either masterpiece or cult classic filing eventually, because I think Neil's right that we need a little bit of time on it. I just wish that I'd walked out of it like, you know, a whole bunch of my reviewing peers walked out of it being like, that's a masterpiece. I witnessed it. I felt it halfway through the movie. Halfway through the movie, what I felt was, if I made a pitch where my two main female characters were named Love and Joy, I would get laughed out of the room. Like, that was my thought in the movie. So I don't know. Maybe I just didn't. I think that they mishandled the marketing of this movie for not showing that it was more than just another Blade Runner, like for not showing how ambitious it got. I think they hinted that it could be with stuff like the shot of giant Joy poking her finger at little Kay. But I think like there was, I think we could have had the plot of the first 20 minutes of this almost 3 hour long movie, and known about the reproduction and known that he was a replicant and maybe lured some more people into what the movie was actually about. This is, I think, one of those weird occasions where I think the studio was way too cautious about everybody going in completely fresh. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's what I'm pissed about.
It's your pro spoilerness, because I do remember they read that statement before our press screening from Denis Villeneuve. It was like, hey, you know, don't ruin the experience. And I'm like, yeah, but your movie gives up that Ryan Gosling's a replicant like 5 minutes in. Like, don't, that's not, you should be okay. The story of him dealing with the fact that he's a replicant who hunts replicants is more interesting than he's just another Blade Runner. You're right on that.
The story, the spoiler warnings you guys were given were very, like, Byzantine. They were crazy. That being said, like, I, like with Star Wars, I wanted to go into this fresh. I tried to avoid it as much as possible in terms of marketing or people talking about the movie. Like, I was annoyed that someone on Twitter was like, oh, Harrison Ford didn't show up till 90 minutes in. Like, okay, well, all right. I guess it doesn't ruin my experience, but I didn't need to or want to know that. So why would you put that on Twitter? I don't understand why. Like, what's the point of that? Anyway. I don't know what my larger point is there. Just, I think I'm at a crisis point with spoiler culture is what's happening.
This is a good time to subscribe to our off-season tour then, because I'm gonna jam a finger in that open wound.
We're gonna spend at least 100 more episodes working that out.
It's like crazy to me that this movie was like, I mean, obviously we're gonna show Harrison Ford because, you know, Harrison Ford is in it, and then in their last trailer is like, here's basically the entire Edward James Olmos scene. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, first of all, you don't need that scene. Like, I'm not gonna argue for not bringing back Edward James Olmos in basically any circumstance, but doesn't we don't need it. He folds a sheep. That's the name of the short story. Hilarious. But, like, man, didn't they put it in the trailer after, like, doing this whole campaign about how you don't want people to know anything and don't ruin the cameos. And, oh, this one, though. That one's fine. I hope that this movie...
But then, like...
Okay.
But then because I didn't watch that trailer and avoided it as much as I could, I didn't know Edward James Olmos was in the movie. And so when that scene happened, I was like, oh, hey, it's Edward James Olmos. And that, like... Oh, hey, carried me through that scene, which is, you're right, completely inessential, except he does, like, the city speak and folds some origami. But, like, it was kind of nice. It was, like, nice that he was there, and they didn't, like, belabor it. They belabored other things in this movie. They didn't belabor that. And it was just, like, a cute little nod for people who care about the original movie, you know? And sorry, sirens.
They're coming for you. The Blade Runners are coming for your replicas.
Oh, no, We've given up too many spoilers.
Yeah. Fun side anecdote. Joanna actually... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So the last thing I saw before I drove off to see this movie was a chat from Joanna that said I didn't like Sean Young. And I was like, oh, I almost made it.
But that's funny. That's funny that I spoiled you, because the only reason I said that in there was because I thought I was in a chat where, like, nobody would either had seen it or wouldn't care.
Well, no, I didn't
you
care.
You and I had already it's had just... a fight about, like, not caring.
No, I didn't care. I just thought it was very hilarious that it was you and it was that, and it was literally, like, if I would have been 5 minutes later, I would have been out the door and not seen that chat. It was funny. I laughed to myself afterwards. But I'm sorry, kind of say, make your siren point.
Well, it just, that something like, I would never call that a spoiler. Like, if someone told me, like, oh, hey, I mean, the marketing did that, right? If the marketing is like, hey, Edward James Olmos is in this, or someone tells me, hey, Edward James Olmos is in the new Blade Runner, like, that's not a spoiler necessarily. But I will say that I think that me being caught off guard because it was such a short scene, just my excitement at seeing him carried me through that. So that if I had been spoiled and like, oh, here we go, Edward James folds the thing, does the city speak. All right, let's move along. You know, like, I don't know. But to be clear, I did not feel that way about Game of Thrones. My relationship with spoilers with Game of Thrones is the same as it ever was. this is just a different crisis.
Well, but that effect that you're talking about, where the excitement of seeing Edward James almost carried you through the scene, will be gone on a rewatch. So I say that scene's worthless. Like, if I'm jump scare, if jump scares get me twice, good, they should have been there. If jump scares get me once, yay, I have ears. Like, it's not. It's like a Pavlovian reaction to seeing Edward James Olmos. That's not a reason to have a scene.
Well, I think the more interesting thing about that scene is being able to discuss it sort of in context. Because what is he? He puts the unicorn down, right? And the unicorn. Oh, he puts a sheep down. But it's like it, like dissecting, like whether or not it. I think that scene is there for bigger reasons.
So you think
maybe, I don't know. I feel reading, like I have to watch it again.
You think he's not reading Kay. He's reading Deckard, who's still a replicant. Just an aging maybe. Replicant.
Or maybe he's trying to tell him something.
I think there are a lot of places in this movie that are made specifically for that ambiguity. I was bringing up earlier that it has this pale fire, pieces of the poem, and then also parts of the novel. The novel, the Pale Flower novel, is a long epic poem, and then it also has notes from an editor, and together they tell this story of these two people that find each other through what ends up being a misprint in a poem. One of them writes a poem about, I think it's a white fountain, and this person finds it and he's like, oh, I've also had visions of this white fountain. And then the editor's like, actually it was supposed to be mountain. But by the time they find each other, they create this feedback loop where the like goal, at least in my basic ass lit reading of Pale Fire, is that the reality, the facts, that those don't matter. All that matters is the perspective and the experience. So at the end, does it matter that she's creating the exact same snow that Ryan Gosling is looking up to as he's like probably dying? Has that whole thing been engineered to that specific moment by her? Is it real for any of them? Or does it just matter that they're both in the snow? And that's why, you know, Deckard can never touch his daughter. There's ambiguity points that I think come close to, is Deckard a replicant? But I don't think there's artfully set up with. Yet, or if they are, I haven't found the reference or layer that triggers that for me yet. So like snow in two places, you know, could just be snow globe imagery and a wrecked like ecosystem, or it could be this symbol for what I'm supposed to get out of the end of the movie.
So It's interesting that you mentioned the Deckard replicant thing, because now that I realize that she didn't have green eyes in the original, I'm now back on team Deckard was a human. So
no,
like,
he's a replicant. He's not a replicant.
He's not a replicant. I don't care what Ridley Scott says. I've spoken to that man. He's crazy.
Okay, he's crazy. Okay, listen. So Ridley Scott is completely bananas bonkers. That's true. But I don't think he's always been crazy. And back before he was crazy, he was saying Deckard was a replicant. And he like got Harrison Ford. And in the podcast I listened to, because he was involved in writing Blade Runner 2049. And in a recent podcast episode that I listened to, he was like, the entire plot of 2049 doesn't make sense if he's a replicant, is what crazy Sir Ridley Scott said. So he's a replicant. All right, let's hear your...
No, wait, it doesn't make sense if he is a replicant, or it doesn't make sense if he isn't a replicant?
Isn't a replicant. If he is human.
No, I still think he's human. There's this him, like, essentially. So what that's saying, since she had brown eyes, is that he's lying about it. So he's essentially pushing the emotion down, and he's like repressing the emotions of love that he had for the young version of Rachel. And he's then lying to do what exactly? I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, the lie thing freaks me out. That's what freaks me out about that scene. But what it's interesting about the Deckard ambiguity is that the premise of that scene is like they have to both be replicants, because otherwise there's no bioengineering reason to need the child. Like, if you just have a model of replicant that was able to reproduce, and it could reproduce with any sperm. You don't need to hunt down sperm guy and have them both in the same place. You just need the child, in theory. But he wants, like, both models and the child? Isn't that how it goes?
Yeah, so that's the larger question here. So the question is, were Deckard and Rachel biologically engineered to be able to procreate with each other, or was Rachel engineered to procreate, but they couldn't get it to work until she fell in love with Deckard?
Well,
so, like, is there, like, a larger...
Well, Wallace says, you know, he, like, brings up the idea that maybe they were made for each other. So I think that means that Deckard at least thinks he's a replicant.
Well, so, like, Wallace says, that's what I think the eye thing is about, right? Okay, so Wallace insinuates, you know, he's like, remember when you first met her? Which I thought was, I actually really liked that use of the original footage. Someone I saw on Twitter hated it, but I thought it was really breathtaking the way they used the original footage there. And, you know, he's like, remember when you met her and, like, what it was all like? And then basically Wallace is like, what you felt was a lie. Like, what if you were what if you were engineered to respond to her?
So but also...
Your love is a lie, right? Like, that's what he's implying, which is a real shit move, right? And he's like, look, we made you another one. It's fine. She's also made for you. This is fine. So he's just cheapening these emotions that Deckard has felt. And so when Deckard, like, walks away and he's like, her eyes are green or whatever, which is a lie, he's saying, you can't just replicate us. You can't just engineer us. You can't just make us again. The Rachel I loved was that Rachel and not just something that looks like her, you know? And to me, that's what that eye color thing means.
I like that reading. See, the more time I spend with this movie, the more I like it.
Unless love was the secret ingredient.
No, because love is the person that stabs Kay. You can't trust love.
L-U-V. It's so funny. It didn't bother me at all that the hologram was called Joy. J-O-I, because, like, that's, like, a branding thing. She brings joy. Like, that's what, I feel like that's what you would name a vibrator or something like that, you know? Like, J-O-I.
Might be a vibrator named Joy.
I'm sure. Like that. This probably is. But, like, but love? Like, why would you name your Terminator robot L-U-V love? That, I was like, this is terrible. That's
oh,
terrible
well,
name.
Because
I hated that whole character.
Because it's Jared Leto. He's fucking weird. Like, if you just assume that character is Jared Leto, it's a lot easier to figure out why he's so fucking weird.
Speaking of crazy people, you heard that that Jared Leto pretended to be blind on set, right?
What?
And that his assistant led him around and that he never saw any of the crew because he just, like, always pretended to be blind.
That's just a way of, like, maybe he just, like, doesn't like people.
I think he just likes making other people's lives difficult for, he says it's for art, but I feel like he just likes the power of it, you know? Like, he inconvenienced a lot of people for that particular experiment. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not very method.
We haven't talked about this really amazing set piece, which is the waves crashing on this fight scene, and how, I don't know if that's, like, where the Christopher Nolan comparison comes in, but, like, that was just incredible, just an incredible thing. And like, it was slightly dented by the fact that I really didn't care about, not that you're supposed to like the love character, I just disliked her. Like, I feel like I've seen other people play that kind of character and it's worked better for me, and I just didn't enjoy her at all. So
she was good, but she was in Tron Legacy, which, you know, she's in the wrong future movie.
Wait, she was in...
Doesn't it feel like love's in Tron Legacy? She's, like, shooting things with their eyeglasses and getting, like, a, like, manicure at the same time?
Yeah, it does feel like she's in a different movie. That's how it felt to me. Also, I read an interview with that actress. She's Dutch, I think, and she gave it to a Dutch newspaper, where she said that they dyed her hair black, and I think she's wearing dark contacts in her eyes, to make her look more Asian was, like, the goal. And she said that she and her friends started, like, speaking Japanese to each other. And as friend of the pod, Katie Rich, rightly pointed out, that's an interview you give a Dutch newspaper. You don't give an American newspaper.
Exactly.
had somebody translate it and it was floating around. But, you know, that makes me want to engage a little bit with the lack of Asian characters. And, you know, Blade Runner is certainly not the only film that's guilty of this, but the use of, like, Asian iconography to be the future without any actual Asian characters. There's like one Asian character in the original Blade Runner, you know, it's James Wong, right? Who like dies really quickly. So what is that about? Maybe stop doing that movies.
Yeah,
it doesn't... Asian characters if you're gonna like make your future Asian.
It doesn't even make sense in the world that they're presenting because all like the atmosphere broke, not the atmosphere, the climate broke and most people went off world. So you think it would just be like the lower class. Maybe what they're trying to say is that the lower class is white, but they're just really fucking it up.
Like LA is basically a ghetto.
I mean, that's what it's,
culture is also.
I think that's what it's supposed to be. It's like all the off-world colonies like have to flourish because the earth is literally dying. There's a lot of stuff that was in the shorts in between, of which I would watch the anime one and the Jared Leto one. You could skip the Dave Bautista one. But yeah, there's like a lot of interesting backstory about why things have to happen the way they do in this movie, which is a sign of good world building, but it's, you know, it's interesting to see, but it doesn't make the race problem any better. It still pisses me off about the first Blade Runner that they like Edward James almost made up city speak. So the only like actual Chinese words we hear are like spoken by a Mexican man in that Asian future. So that is one of the things I'd hoped had been better. I'd also hoped that they'd like updated the themes like I had updated my watching of the first movie, but this movie seems to be content existing on its own in a vacuum and making us poke at it until we feel okay about it, or at least that's where I'm slowly getting to.
And I think that was the first one too, like the first one you really popular. There's some people who liked it when it first came out, but it was not popular, and then just over time people like chewing over its themes and appreciating its visuals. I think that's how it achieved its either cult classic or masterpiece status, however you want to put it. And I really do think that history will be kind to Blade Runner 2049. Like, film geeks, at least. Like, you know, film geeks come... Because Denis Villeneuve is a film geek who, like, I saw him give an interview about on the re-release of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? Like, he was watching those movies and getting ideas. And the next generation is going to watch Blade Runner 2049... And I'm sure Blade Runner as well. And the next generation is going to watch Blade Runner 2049 and get ideas. And I'm so glad that exists because, I mean, what he accomplished is just amazing. But what's also true about Denis Villeneuve movies is that they're all slow. Arrival is slow. Sicario is slow, too. Like, he doesn't do non-ponderous films. So, like, I know the average moviegoer who doesn't, like, bother to care about that because they have more important things to worry about. Don't know that, but like it would be nice if that word got out so that people weren't so fucking depressed when they're like, oh, this movie is slow. I was like, oh, like all the new Villeneuve movies ever? Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm into that. I'm still waiting for him to have his I want him to make a movie for me. He hasn't made a movie for me yet. He's made a lot of really good movies. And it's a super selfish thing to ask for, but if that's what I'm going to ask for, there's like a version of Prisoners for me, and there's a version of Blade Runner 2049 for me, and you know both of those movies came really close to being awesome, but just didn't execute. The good thing is
Dave,
that.
How do you feel about Cleopatra?
How do I?
Because he's going to make that
Dune.
Movie.
Dune.
I mean, if he does Dune, I'm into seeing Dune just to see what's up with that. But yeah, Cleopatra, whatever. I mean, the nice thing is that Joanna's right in that he's proven that he can do a certain type of movie and can consistently deliver that in ways that are fun to watch, if nothing else. All my complaints are about plotting and choices in like post-production. So if this guy wants to go out and spend hundreds of millions of dollars making Cleopatra again, I'm into that spectacle. I just hope that, you know, he has some good screenwriters and post-production people on his side. But like, if he keeps choosing cinematographers, he's okay in my book.
What's interesting is that I have a reputation earned for saying spectacle shouldn't matter if there isn't like good story there. And I think the story of Blade Runner is good. I think it could use a bit of a trim, but it is good. But I'm with both of you, I think, on this, which is just like the visuals, like a battle episode of Game of Thrones, good visuals is not going to float it for me. But the visuals of this could just float this for me. It's just jaw-dropping to look at.
But I think what we're experiencing here is the difference between like spectacle for its own sake and like just like there's just a next level of spectacle that can exist that feels like something completely different. What's great about 2049 is that it feels like something completely new and different and fresh, and it's literally based on something. Whereas like battle episodes in Game of Thrones, you can sort of go through the other medieval battle things that have existed and kind of piece it together, like where all the inspiration came from, which I think actually is why the Lutrain battle was great, because it felt like something we'd never really seen before.
How dare you use that phrase?
But I think that, you know, people who are anti-spectacle are generally right when criticizing like a Michael Bay movie, like Michael Bay Transformers movie. Don't at me about the early ones. But when it comes to like the kind of spectacle that they're creating here, sometimes that's good enough. And sometimes it's so good that you can't look past it. You can't start to pick it apart and feel good about yourself. Unless you're Dave, I guess.
Yeah. Unless you're Dave.
That's right. I'll pick apart everything. Yeah, guys. I don't know. I guess we're going to have to give me some more time in the oven before I'm ready to slap a cult classic or masterpiece thing on this movie. Is anybody okay at least making a prediction on one or both?
I'm trying to think if like it has, you know, because like the way that the original Blade Runner survives is like on Sean Young's iconic look, Daryl Hannah's weirdness, and the fucking Tears in the Rain speech, you know, and then like the Vangelis score. That's, you know, that's what Blade Runner is to a lot of people. And I don't know that this has, I mean, that giant shot that's in every trailer of the hologram of like Joy with the blue wig, like, oh, that's some iconic shit. Or the fight in Vegas with the holograms, like, that's some iconic shit too. So like, maybe it does have enough visual imagery and iconography to make it last in pop culture. I'm just gonna need more people to see it. Maybe when it comes, when it's streaming, people will discover it. I don't know.
I think that in 20 years, no, let's go shorter. In the next 10 years, at some point, Denis Villeneuve is going to make a movie that sort of perfects all of it, the spectacle, and he's going to get the pace right, and he's going to get the story right. And it might even be, you know, an original story, potentially. Who knows? But he's going to make a movie that makes $1 billion at the box office, and this will be his underrated masterpiece. Like, people will go back and be like, you know what? 2049 was really underrated.
You know what? I think The Prestige is Christopher Nolan's best film. It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be like that. It's harder because it's like a big studio movie that got plenty of marketing, but also, I mean, The Prestige did too. It was made at Warner Brothers. So I feel like that's going to be it. Like, he's going to make a really great, amazing movie. that like everyone's going to love, and people are going to go back and rediscover how legit good 2049 was.
I'm going to say cult classic. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I like give Denis Villeneuve a Batman movie.
Basically, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't know. Give him a superhero movie already.
I'm going to say cult classic, but I am going to say that this movie uses the visual of the artificial girlfriend better, that now when we do get artificial girlfriends, no one's going to reference her anymore. They're going to be like Blade Runner 2049. That's
right.
That's going to be the trigger that's going to send people back to be like, that that movie.
That freaking technology of like just the light glinting through her enough that like, and she goes from solid to like, I thought that like when she's introduced and she keeps switching outfits, I thought that was kind of annoying and distracting. But when you just have her and like just every so often, it reminds you that she's not solid, or when she's glitching, man, it's just so good. And then that sex scene, which is amazing. We haven't talked about that sex scene with Mackenzie Davis, who I don't think the film used her as well as it might have. Then the like, could you go from the sex scene to then the shot of like the joy billboard? Oh, it's good. So good. Such good visual commentary, theme, everything coming together. Blade Runner 2049.
Blade Runner 2049. All women are viable. All right. That was a moral, right? Let's quickly shuttle off that topic. And instead, Neil, give us a peek on what we're doing next week.
Next week, we're doing a mystery episode.
That's
all I'm saying.
All right.
We don't have a topic yet.
Oh, I was like, did I miss something? Okay.
No, just, you know what? So we had not come up with a good topic for next week. So it's a mystery until we actually record it. So that's fine. It'll be a mystery. Miss it.
Yeah, that's right. And you know how you not miss it? You listen really carefully to this part that comes right here. Joanna, where could people find you on the internet this week?
You can find me at Joe Wrote This on Twitter. Not very much, but a little bit on vanityfair.com. And those are the places.
Those are the places. Neil Miller.
You can maybe find me on Twitter at Rejects. I don't know. Twitter is depressing. Sometimes I don't do it that much. You can also find me writing things at filmscorerejects.com, editing things at filmscorerejects.com. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers on the Twitter or Storm of Spoilers on the Facebooks. And if you have any questions, comments, Blade Runner thoughts, or continued suggestions for other things we should cover in the off-season tour, since we're currently searching for a topic for next week, email stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find my other podcast, Fighting in the War Room, at fightinginthewarroom.com. You could find my writing at Thrillist. And until next time, we will all take our post-trauma standard test and get back to you.